The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and it's Friday night. It's one of those special Friday nights. We get to do a little walk through history then and now with Harry Cooper, who really qualifies in my book as one of the great historians of our time. He is, of course, dedicated to World War II history and what happened during and after, and has a whole library of books about this. His big book, his biggest book, is, of course, Hitler in Argentina: The Truth About Eva Braun and Adolf, or Adolf, however you wish to pronounce it, and their successful escape, even though if it wasn't in the beginning their idea, it was Martin Bormann's idea, to Argentina, where they both lived out their natural lives. And we don't know that Eva Braun may still be alive. It's possible. She could be 103 or something now, so... She was supposedly alive 5-6 years ago, or even maybe even more recently than that. Okay. Are you up there, young man? Are you doing all right?
I'm still awake. I've been up for 20 hours straight so far, but I'm hanging in there. I just had a big chunk of chocolate cake and some chocolate milk, and that ought to get me running for a while.
And that was after the taco with lots of hot sauce?
That's right. That's right. You got to have something like chocolate cake and chocolate milk to cool down the picante sauce on the tacos.
How do I got to tell you the truth. I have never understood how people can eat something that is so awfully uncomfortable to the mouth. It burns the hell out of you, some of that stuff. And
yeah,
people just eat. Do they become desensitized to it? Is that it?
I don't know. I don't use the picante. I use the salsa roja, which is not quite so hot as the picante. But
some of this stuff, you know, is like nitro. I mean, it just some of these what do they call them? Barbecue sauces? No, I don't know. Anyway, they got these things. Hot sauces. And they really should have to have a some kind of a government permit for these things. I think if they poured them on the surface, they would eat through it. And yet they just wolf this stuff. They can't feel it. They can't. There must be something missing in their physiology.
I don't know. I had a buddy many, many years ago who would drink a lot, and then he'd have a Bloody Mary, and, you know, you got to throw in a little Tabasco sauce. This guy would drink an entire small bottle of Tabasco sauce.
Just down the Tabasco sauce.
Yeah. He was no fun to be around after that.
No way.
He had no chance. All sorts of smells and odors. It was kind of like a green cloud surrounding the guy. But, the back of his throat's got to be gone by now,
I would think. I never did understand that.
But you got to do what you got to do to stay awake. I normally knock off for a while in the afternoon to watch a little TV and take a nap. Yeah, I sound like an old man when I say it. Take a nap.
No. Listen, children start out taking naps and they quit for some reason. And I don't care what age you are, if you were to lay down and take a half an hour nap every day, you'd feel better. So forget that.
Well, that's what I do because, as you know, I'm usually in my office by about 3 in the morning, and I go until about 10 or 11, and I take a snoozer for a bit, then I go have lunch and back to work.
Yeah. What's really funny is a lot of times I'm still working and not going to bed yet, and Harry's just getting going. You're up and I'm still up. So
yeah, there's got to be something wrong with the both of us.
I would think. Yeah. All right. What were we going to say?
Well, I was going to say, and the fact that I don't take a salary from shark hunters at all, and I put in about, on a normal day, 12 to 14 hours.
That's my game, too.
Yeah. I do it because, first off, I absolutely love it. But you know, these wonderful old vets like Otto Kretschmer, Erich Topp, and Reinhard Hardigan, who were all friends of mine, they gave me all their information. They trusted me, and I told them I would just continue to keep their history alive and accurate. So
yeah,
you can't turn your back on a promise.
No, no, that's a great honor, and to have had the opportunity to meet so many, and there are still some around.
Right, Hardigan just turned 101 some months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I got an email from his son, the three kids, the two sons and the daughter, they're all panic-stricken because at 101 years old, he's still driving his car. He's got a big Mercedes, and he's still driving.
Bless that. Nothing wrong with that. That's great. That is just great.
He'd fit in well down here in Florida.
A lot of that down there?
Oh, old people, for God's sake, doing 20 miles an hour under the speed limit. No blinkers.
Just blue hair.
Yeah, right. We call them Q-tips. All you see is a little fuzz of fur sticking up around.
That's terrible.
Sometimes you don't even see a person. You pull up beside this big Cadillac or Lincoln, you look over and there's a pair of hands sticking up and clutching the wheel, and you look over there and there's some little woman that's about 4 foot tall driving this monster car.
That's funny.
So I drive a 3/4 ton Suburban that way.
To protect yourself, of course.
Betcha.
Yeah, now I have an older SUV and a 97, and I want to get as much metal around me as I can.
Right, mine's an 87 with over 300,000 miles on it.
Gee. Well, when we talk to Harry, we get to look at pictures, too. So let me invite all of you to go to Rents and look on the left-hand side, look for guests, and you'll see Harry's name right there. Under Harry's name, it says World War II history, and then photos. And I'll bet you can figure out which one to click on so you can follow along and watch the interesting pictures that he has so many of. It's just remarkable. But he does take trips, and he takes folks along, and these folks get to not relive World War II history, but experience it in a way that suggests time travel is real, not only just the people, but the buildings, the architecture, the scars in the earth, all kinds of things. There are still relics around, lots.
Oh, yeah. Not so much in the two tours we're going to be talking about this evening, but others we sometimes go, well, on our southern patrol, which we'll talk about, sometimes we go down to the little town of Reda Puglia, just over the border into Italy, and that's where Erwin Rommel earned his Pour le Mérite, otherwise known as the Blue Max, when he was just a young officer. And the trenches are still there. You can go into the trenches.
Really?
They've got great museum there, and you can go into the trenches. The mayor is a really, really neat guy, and got a pretty boxy wife. You know, you can see the artifacts still there. you can't pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we go to Sevastopol in the Crimea. And again, the Battle of Sevastopol, the slit trenches are all there, and there's stuff laying around on the ground. That,
what do you mean stuff?
Oh, little, you know, like shell casings, and but they're in pretty rough shape, and they've been pretty well picked through by now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just like, a brick from Uncle Adolf's house. It's pretty hard to come by.
I heard that. I heard that. I need to get a, I just have always wanted to get a really good picture of that house.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
For framing purposes.
Yeah, well, send me an email. Remind me. I'm an old man. I forget things.
Right. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I forget things. Send me an email because I have one that I can maybe scan and send to you.
Oh, a color scan would be perfect or whatever.
Yeah, a color photo.
Yeah.
It
Great.
Was hanging on my wall in my living room, but my wife took down all my pictures like that, all hand-signed by Otto Kretschmer and Erich Topp and Hans-Georg Hest and those guys.
Would she move you to your office?
No, she put them away and put up a picture of the Eiffel Tower. She just really wants to go to Paris one day, and I told her, don't waste your time. I've been to Paris. It's a filthy city. mean, nasty people that not only hate Americans, they hate everybody. But I'm sitting here looking at a picture of the Eiffel Tower, where those pictures used to be. She didn't dare take down the picture of my Corvette, though.
Well, no, good. That's nice. And obviously, the Eiffel Tower is preferential to sleeping in the garage, so...
You mean I gotta have a garage now? No, that she's a good lady, and I let her decorate however she wants. But these are all very, very valuable pictures.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
Like I say, send me an email, remind me, and
I will.
I'll scan that color picture of the Berghof.
Yeah, I'm going to hope to find a photo of a period toilet too to go with it. Now, the pictures, please load the pictures up, folks. It's right under Harry Cooper's name. And you will have a fun time as we walk through all these things in the next couple of hours. I have something that maybe some of you, I don't know if there are any car people out there, but in 1958 was probably the best in terms of, well, the Cadillac made a lot of beautiful cars. But the 58 Cadillac Seville is priceless. It had those inboard shark fins on the back. If you look at 1958 Cadillac Seville, you'll see the picture of the car. And there were only 855 hard tops and 855 convertible Sevilles made in 1958. That's it.
Convertible?
No, it's a two-door.
Okay, because they made some four-door convertibles back then, too.
Well, this is it's called the Biarritz.
And, oh, okay.
And they go for $200,000 to $300,000.
Yep.
If you can find them. I'm not a convertible fan. You probably like convertibles, but being in Florida, you might. But I happen to know of a 1958 Cadillac Seville hardtop two-door. One owner car, never been repainted. It's in perfect immaculate condition. Never been hit, garaged its whole life, and the fellow that owned it passed on some time ago. And if you're at all interested in that car, let me know and I'll send you some pictures. And I'll just leave it at that. It is it's like a barn find. It's perfect. The guy took absolutely immaculate care of that car.
He's looking for a couple of bucks on that one.
Not as much as you'd think. We're looking, around 50, 55-ish in there.
Wow, that would be a deal.
Yeah, it is. It's quite a neat car. Anyway, let's get to some pictures here. They're entitled, we're talking about toilets and cars, Cadillac. See, we get right to the issue. By the way, I wanted to say one other thing. Today the title of the film Das Boot came up, and for all of you who have not seen that, if you want to experience legitimately what World War II German U-boat life and death was like, you must watch the film. I don't know if you'd recommend the subtitled version or the dubbed version. Which would you recommend, Harry?
I've got three or four different versions. I've even got the 5.5 hour long version.
They'd cut that much, and somebody put it back together. Wow.
Yeah, and then there was a 4 hour, I think, director's cut,
mm-hmm.
and then the regular film. And you're right, it is an incredible film. There are many submarine movies, but there's only one Das Boot, and you pronounced it correctly. It's not Das Boot. It's not a piece of footwear.
Yeah.
To a German, B-O-O-T is boat, and it is an incredible, and it's based on a true story. The guy who played the young lieutenant who was taking all the pictures, the guy who got the greasy rag thrown in his face, that's the guy that wrote the book, Das Boot. Buchheim, the guy that all the U-boaters love to hate, and the skipper, who did not get killed in real life, was Heinrich Lehmann Willenbrook, who was also a member of Shark Hunters until his death. He was one of only 28 skippers to be decorated with the Knight's Cross with Oak Leaf.
Remarkable.
Yeah, only 28 skippers got that decoration.
I haven't seen the film for many years, but I'll never forget the scene at night when they were surfaced, and I guess they were blasting through the Straits of Gibraltar.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the most dramatic scenes that I've ever seen in a film. Just remarkable.
A lot of boats didn't make it through there. Most of them got turned back, not sunk. But one of our members, who's now dead, who's a dear friend of mine, Garrett Tater, he came through Gibraltar twice. He came through as a first officer on one submarine, and then they were based at Toulon. And then he got ordered back to Germany to take over his own submarine, and he brought that through Gibraltar. And another one of our members, Kurt Baberg, commander of 618, he got his boat so beat up he had to turn around and head back for a French base. And another one of our members, Günter Heinrich, his was the last boat to make it through Gibraltar in the war. Nobody else made it through after that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
These guys were tough. These guys, you know, they're the greatest generation. That's exactly right, but it applies to more than just the American veterans. These German guys, they were tough as nails, too.
Oh, thank you for saying that. It's hard to believe it was just not that long ago. No computers, no color TVs, no satellite images,
no GPS.
No, none of that. And they just men and machines, and most of the machines from America were built by women. A lot of them were anyway. So
yeah, my mother worked in a company called Amatorp. They built torpedoes.
There you go.
So, you know, they talk about innocent civilians in a major war. There are no such things because the people at home
they're involved in the war effort.
The war.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm not saying you should kill them all. I'm saying war sucks. It's a horrible thing. But, you know, that's the last time that this country was really united behind a cause. Right now, you know, well, you know what it's like right now. But
sure do.
I was alive during the war. I was a kid during the war years, and I was a teenager in the 50s.
Yeah.
Just like happy days. It was a great time in this country.
That's that probably the 1950s was the apotheosis. Is that the right word? Yeah.
It was
the high point of American family values, morality. At least that was the external part of it that we saw and lived.
Yeah,
what was going on in the political arena was dark and dirty, like always. But
that it didn't spill over to the populace like it is today.
For the population at large, the 1950s were without question the best years, probably in the history of this country.
Yep, and thank God I lived through it as a teenager. It was wonderful.
Absolutely. Yep. Understand. Okay, let's go to summer solstice, our photo parade for tonight, and take a trip with Harry, who's doing just great considering he's been up almost 24 hours straight.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll
too
sleep.
Dumb to know any better. And then I have to get up early tomorrow morning because I'm going to shindig we have here in Hillbilly Heaven where I live. Local authors present their works, etc. So I got to be out the door by 0900.
Wow. Oh, my God. All right. Well, don't get up at 03.
No. Well, I get up when I wake up. Who knows what the heck. But anyhow, yeah, the first batch, they're all, the photos are coded SS with a number, and that has nothing to do with the SS. There's a Schutzstaffel that is short for summer solstice.
Okay.
And this, the summer solstice and the winter solstice also are still big in Europe, but this one at this place is especially interesting because it was run by a fellow named Manfred Roeder, who was allegedly the most radical right winger in all of Germany. Terrible threat to social upheaval over there, but in reality, he was like a Sunday school teacher. He was just a nice old man, and he was a good friend of mine. And this was his home, and he put on this shindig every year. And, I remember one time on a summer or a winter solstice, I'm sorry, it was just like you'd see in the old wartime movies. There was tons of people there, and he had a huge kitchen, And all the women were out in the kitchen cooking some incredible food. The guys were all in the salon or whatever you want to call it, main room, drinking beer, except for me. I'm not a very good Irishman. I don't drink beer. And I was playing chess with one of the people there. And they had the ceremony. And we go there every year. Then you'll notice I put the email address on these photos also. So we'd like your listeners to go to the website. The web address is there. And also they can contact me directly at that email. And if they think they might like information on the next solstice celebration, which is June, of course, the end of June, let us know, because we take people over there. And you'll see in photo SS 1, 2, and 3, this is just a small bunch of us hanging around in that big home. There's 20 rooms in that home. And in photo SS 4, that is the house itself. Manfred has passed away a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and the place was bought by a very nice, very wealthy English lady who we'll talk about in a short.
Okay.
As you look at photo SS5.
Let me look at SS4 for a minute.
Okay.
While we have to pause here, take a break. Where is the house exactly located again?
It's about...
I know, what? I need a street address, but...
There isn't one. It's out in the farm country. It's about... 2 hours north of Frankfort, sort of right in the center of Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, look at that stonework around the bottom. Basement.
Oh, it's a beautiful place.
Yeah. Okay, hold on, we'll be right back. Harry and I will continue in just a few minutes. Okay, looking at a very beautiful house with some interesting folks. One of them is even named Jeff.
it's an interesting name, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it before.
Yeah.
All right. So where are we? We're at number five.
Four. Well, number four. And then we'll move on. This
All
fellow,
right.
Manfred Roeder,
uh-huh.
he was in the Hitler Youth Division under Arthur Axman in the defense of Berlin when he was like 14 years old.
Wow.
His father was a major, and he was the third Führer of the old Third Reich. Hitler gave the power over to Gross Admiral Dönitz,
uh-huh.
and when he was spirited away, and Dönitz spent 10 years and 20 days in Spandau prison. He thought he was going to be executed, and if it hadn't been for our own Admiral Nimitz, they would have executed him. And Nimitz sent over a document saying that Dönitz ran his submarines the same way we ran ours.
Huh.
Then when Dönitz finally got out of prison, Manfred met up with him. Manfred was a doctor of law.
Uh-huh.
And asked Dönitz, well, who's going to be the Führer when you die? And Dönitz says something like, who cares? And Manfred says, what about me? And Dönitz says, who cares? And so he had a document already drawn up. I saw it. Dönitz signed it, and Manfred was the third Führer of the old Third Reich.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, he also had some of Hitler's paintings in his house, and Hitler was a pretty good artist.
Don't talk about that.
Okay.
Gosh. I had 6 of them.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, that's right. I think we talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ouch.
And a World War II historian took them for authentication.
Yeah.
And kept going.
Well, he never said he was going to return them, did he? He just said he was going to take them.
That's about it. No, they weren't anything. They were small, like 4x6 little index card
right.
size things that Hitler used to draw.
Right.
In the cafe, sitting outside when he was a struggling art student.
Right.
Trying to
yes.
get into the academy.
You still don't want anything stolen from you, no matter what it is.
No. Of course it is. And some were pencil. There were a couple in watercolors. And then there was about an 8x10 in pencil. I have perfect photocopies of all these. I took the guy to court and won, but he just declared bankruptcy and left.
Yeah, there you are.
So, well, anyway, I was thinking of putting the pictures up and offering a reward for them. I just would like one of them back. I mean, I paid for them. But the 8x10 is beautiful countryside, village, and anyway, I should probably just put them up for fun.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever works. Incidentally, that fella, Jeff, you were talking about, we call him the Tunnel King. You see his name in our magazine. You've got our magazine all the time. This guy is incredible. He does research like nobody I've ever seen on the bunkers and tunnels, and he goes to a place where there's nothing but a hillside, and he digs a little bit, and damn, there's the entrance to a whole bunker system. I've been with him on some of these things, and this guy, he's just a little guy. He's only about 5'5", and probably doesn't weigh 110 pounds. This guy can walk the legs off a pool table. He thinks nothing of walking 5-10 miles up and down mountains looking for all these things. And I was with him on one of these jaunts.
That's amazing.
I was just beat to a frazzle. And he said, well, let's stop for lunch. I said, okay, fine. He said, well, there's a great bistro right over the next mountain.
Over the next mountain.
I said, I'll go get the car. He said, no, we can just walk it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'll see you over there. Anyhow, moving on. I know you're watching your clock. We go to SS5 and... also SS6, SS7, 8.
All right. We're carrying candles.
Torches.
Uh-huh.
Torches. This is a torchlight parade out to the meadow, which is all part of the ceremony, because this is not only for the solstice, this is also for the old Germanic ways, as far as Manfred was putting it together. And there was a lot of people there, but it's kind of a ragtag group. And you can tell these people were not military trained. They just kind of shuffled along.
Yeah.
And that one fellow there, Roy, he's somewhat of a radical right-winger. He lives in Germany. He's an American, lives in Germany. But he's not allowed to have a job because he's a right-winger.
Mm-hmm.
And...
right as in correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can I tell you? You and I are singing out of that same songbook. But anybody who goes with us on these tours, they'll meet all these people. They'll participate in this torchlight parade. And then we have the giant bonfire. And if you look in picture SS9, before we set it on fire, you see that person with the red jacket kind of in the background?
I do.
Okay, look just beyond that. What do you see? You see a car.
A car.
Guess who?
You don't want to walk over the next mountain.
No, well, no, that's the Polizei. The police.
Oh, they came to watch, because is a reactionary right wing.
Oh, because we're all horrible.
Politically incorrect.
That's right.
Nazi demonstration.
Right.
I get.
And the cops, they all think it's just ridiculous that they have to do that. And one winter we were there, and... They had cars all around the place, and
really?
Oh yeah. And we were driving back from the train station. Manfred asked me to take him to the train station to pick up a couple friends. And as we were coming back, there's only a little narrow road going up to his place, and there was a line of cops across the road. And this was winter time. so we stopped. And as one cop came up, and I rolled down the window, and he said something to me. And, well, he asked where we were going, Bovunzi. And, of course, then all of a sudden I don't speak German. I speak hillbilly. I said, well, I don't know what y'all are saying, Sheriff, but I'll bet it's important. And he said, where are you going? Manfred just said, Vogelhaus, which is the name of a restaurant. It means birdhouse. It's the name of a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the... officer in charge. Well, there you have it, Sheriff. Okay, you have a good day. I said, well, thank you, Sheriff. Y'all look mighty cold out there. He let us through, and the two people in the back, they're just busting a gut that the cop didn't catch on that was Manfred, the most dangerous man in all
of Germany.
Christendom, yeah. So But then the other, then later they had this black Mercedes SUV parked right in front of his house. And Manfred says, you know, they're not even allowed to take a cup of coffee from him, even though they think it's ridiculous that they should be sitting there. So I said, okay, come on. Put together a tray with a bunch of sweet cakes and coffee and everything. And a bunch of us went out there, and we had this one Japanese lady with us who could speak perfect English. Anyhow, I said, but you just rattle off something in Japanese, and I'll tell them what I want them to know. So they rolled down the window, and she's chattering on in Japanese, and I said, she's telling you, officers, that in Japan, at Christmas time, it's customary for the citizens to give thanks to the police officers by giving them coffee and cake, and she would be very offended if you don't take the coffee and cake. Oh, they were so happy they had the coffee and cake and thought it was ridiculous they had to be sitting there.
Nice story. Nice story.
But anybody who wants to go with us on those on these tours, just send me an email, and I can send them the information.
So it's on the website, too. Hold on a minute, folks. Right. We have to pause. Harry and I will be right back.
Rock and roll.
Okay, back with Harry, and we're looking at a pretty neat bonfire.
Oh, yeah. It goes for quite a while, and there's speeches and then singing around there, and there's usually about 100 or so people. They come from several countries, Germany, of course, Austria, France, Holland, Russia. One time they had a whole contingent come from Russia, and it's pretty well attended. And like I say, any of your listeners, they can get information. Just send me an email. The address is there. And then if you look at photos 13 and 15, that's the lady who bought the place, and she's keeping the tradition alive now that Manfred's dead.
Lady Michelle dead?
Yeah. You know who that is?
Well, of course. She's been on the program before.
Okay.
I know her.
Michelle, Lady Renew.
Renew.
The Countess Gryaznov. She's my buddy.
Interesting. Yeah. Tell her hello. She works and knows David Irving, as you know. And she's very, very well connected. She's been to Iran.
She was at
She gets around.
Yeah, she was at that shindig that, what was that little bearded guy named it?
Former president.
Yeah, president of Iran. I can't remember his name, though. Ahmadinejad, wasn't it?
That's the one.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, she's a nice lady. A lot of impressive people.
So does she live in the house part of the time then?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Long story.
Well, the artworks are probably no longer there either.
Well, unfortunately, when Manfred got older and his health was failing, this one fella befriended him. It's the guy Manfred met when he was in prison, because he spent a lot of time in prison. He was outspoken, right wing. The government doesn't like to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And he met this guy who was only interested in himself. He put a wedge between Manfred and all his friends, and he put a wedge between Manfred and his family. And he pretty well took over, because the German government pays people as caregivers to elderly people. And those Hitler paintings disappeared, and who knows what happened.
Yeah, well, they were sold, obviously.
Yeah, and the other guy was not in prison for political things. He was in prison for armed bank robbery.
Well, there you go.
Except he didn't know that his buddies were going to rob the bank. They just needed a ride to the bank and back, he said.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Yes, right.
And that's why he had a gun.
You know, you don't take the spots off a leopard.
That's right.
It doesn't happen.
Or as Joe Biden would say, the leopard doesn't change its stripes.
Yes, Joe would.
Well, he did say that. That was a comment he made a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he's a case.
Oh yeah, he's a clown.
Okay, SS 14, that is definitely not Lady Renew.
Nope. Let's see, where did I... SS-14, that is...
The fellow, it looks like Rasputin's half-brother.
He's an interesting guy. He's also an artist. He does incredible work, the old Norse gods type stuff. If you want to see some of his work, when you send me an email to remind me about the scan of the Virchow, ask me about him too. He's an incredible painter. He does it, or he's the caretaker of the stuff for the artist, but it's just fantastic. I was going to produce a line of those pictures, but just never got around to it.
Hmm.
You know, God only gives you so many hours in a day. And
not
you have
enough
to waste some of that time sleeping.
Yeah, that's the truth. That's the truth. Okay, and 15, another picture with you and
that's just after
Lady Michelle.
Yeah, after the shindig is all over, there's a few of us hung around to help clean up.
A few of us hung over, you said? Hung around.
Around. I told you, I'm a lousy Irishman. I don't drink. I used to back when I was driving Grand National stock cars. Boy, oh boy, we'd have parties for a while before the races.
I've heard that.
Oh, yeah. Not the day of the race, obviously.
No.
But whenever we'd get together, lots of big black cigars, hard liquor, and fast women.
Mm-hmm.
I don't miss the cigars or the whiskey.
I didn't hear that.
No, the lifestyle was great. I loved it. Lots of parties.
Well, you were literally in the fast lane. I mean, literally in the fast lane.
190 miles an hour.
Doesn't get any faster than that.
Yeah, and, you hear the old stories, and it's all propaganda. You hear the stories about when the professional racer gets out on the highway, he drives very carefully and casually, carefully and
conservatively.
Conservatively, yeah. Maloney, don't ever believe that.
that would be quite a twist. I wouldn't buy it.
Yeah. There's so many stories. One of these days, I got to write a book about my racing efforts. Boy, that was. It's just by the grace of God any of us survive. I mean, off the track. On the track, you're plenty safe, but off the track, some of the clowning around, but that's not what your listeners want to hear about anyhow.
Oh, it is too, but we can't do that
tonight.
Recently this fellow ran over another driver who was stupid
George,
enough. What the hell is that all about?
Well, I think it was ridiculous that the sheriff wanted to get his 15 minutes of fame by having an inquest on everything.
Had to.
What kind of I've raced short tracks and I've raced the super speedways. What kind of idiot would step out into a track, for Christ's sake?
I have no idea, unless he was on, I don't know, was he on something? I don't know.
I read that they found marijuana in his system.
Well, that doesn't make you that nuts.
No, but it makes you stupid to be high on anything while you're driving a race car.
He was driving, that's right, he cracked up. If he had been smoking and drinking, that's immediate banishment from the circuit, I would think.
Well, this was a short track. This was a local track. This was not NASCAR or ARCA or any of the big outfits. But, you just can't do that.
And, no.
Okay, so Tony Stewart apparently did spin him out, and everybody was on the yellow flag, and they were coming around again. They weren't doing but about 35 miles an hour because they were under a yellow flag on a dirt track, a short track, 35 or 40. And this guy come out, and he's shaking his fist at Tony Stewart, and somehow he went under the wheels. And, now they're talking about his parents might sue Tony Stewart. You know, what the hell? Come on, it's the kid's fault. It's a sad thing, as you know. Well, this Saturday would have been my son's 50th birthday, but he's missed the last 30 of them because he did something stupid when he was 20, and he got killed. So,
it's tomorrow again?
Sunday. Yeah.
Sunday. Well,
the 19th.
Yeah, my best wishes and thoughts. I'm sorry.
Thank you. That day, which is his birthday, and the 22nd of July, which is the day I got the call from the police, saying that he wasn't coming home. But nobody needs to be around me on those days. But, getting back to this kid, maybe he was just putting on a show, because here's this big hotshot superstar, Tony Stewart, there on the little Dinkwater dirt track. And, but, you know, he paid the price.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
And Tony, I read somewhere where he may not race again, or say he's really depressed over this, understandably.
Right. I had a buddy when I was driving short track in Chicago, and he got into a wreck and he killed another guy. And everybody, including the other guy's widow, said Frank did nothing wrong. It's just one of those things that happened. But he never raced again. He sold his car. So,
yeah,
you never go out there expecting somebody to get killed. You go out there expecting to have a lot of fun on a short track. You expect to bend up a lot of tin and maybe scuff up your knuckles afterwards in the pits. But you never expect anybody to be killed. And stock car racing is very, very safe sport. You got a better chance of getting hurt playing pro football than you do.
Oh, yeah.
Racing.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
Right. Well, let's go on to photos number two. Or one more picture there. Just a group of you.
We were just sitting around after the, after everybody else had gone home. And, you know, we were kind of the cleanup crew. That's me, a bad picture of me. And, that lady Michelle, Vic, a very proud German fellow, Victor, and Sean, that huge big guy from Ireland. And we just stayed around to help straighten the joint up so that Lady Michelle didn't have to do it all herself.
Harry Cooper doing dishes? I don't think so.
No, I wasn't doing dishes. As a matter of fact, if you look at those pictures, you see those huge, big, heavy brown drapes. I hung those myself.
Huh.
And I helped straighten up the tables and chairs. But some of the ladies stayed around. They did the dishes. We just helped straighten things up.
Got it. I won't say anything about how well hung the drapes are. Let's see. Next group of pictures coming up for you folks after the break here, which comes up in just a minute.
Right.
Let me remind you, go to this website and look around, sharkhunters.com. The magazine is magnificent. I don't know how one man has put together such an enterprise so thoroughly and so intelligently and so professionally, and yet with such care and concern. It's a real tribute to Harry Cooper. This is Yours Truly, and we will be back. Okay, it's the Jeff and Harry program for you on this Friday night as we meander through lots of interesting pictures, fun pictures, a little spirited repartee from time to time as well. All right, series number two, photos number two. There he is hugging. That's it, hugging.
I'm just putting our best foot forward.
I can't see your feet. Never mind.
She probably hasn't been able to see her feet either.
Oh, my. This is a family program?
Yeah.
All right. That's an old stock car joke. I haven't heard that one in a long time.
She's the owner of a quiet little out-of-the-way bistro where I meet with some of our special people over there who don't want to be seen in public. People give
go.
Me all sorts of fantastic information.
Yeah. And when you go there on tours, folks who go with you can, if you're going there, get a chance to get some really amazing material.
We go places that other people can't go. Eingang verboten means shark hunters are welcome here.
Please, yes.
Yeah, and that lady whose name conveniently escapes me right now.
Guilt.
Is that
all right.
What it is?
Yes.
Okay, look to photo number two. Now we're in Nuremberg.
You notice how quickly he segued? All right. Nuremberg. Okay, is that the infamous courthouse there?
No, that's not the courthouse. They call it the Palace of Justice. No, this is the office of the Nuremberger Zeitung, the Nuremberg newspaper, but it used to be the newspaper there was called Der Stürmer, which was run by a guy named Stryker,
mm-hmm.
who was I think he was the Gauleiter in that area, but he was rather hard to get along with for anybody. Julius Stryker, and he got thrown out of his job. But since he was personal friends with Hitler, they couldn't really do anything to him. So when the war was over, he was on the want list, and he was hiding up in the Bavarian mountains. He was painting pictures. He was a good painter, apparently, artist.
Mm-hmm.
And what did him in, some American GIs were up there looking over his shoulder, watching him paint. And one of the guys says, geez, you look just like that Julius Stryker. Well, if he had any sense, he would have said, yeah, I get that all the time.
Oh.
Oh, he starts denying it and everything, so they dragged him back to town, and, oh, yeah, it was Julius Stryker. And they hanged him.
Jeez.
Actually, those guys were not hanged. Their sentence was to be strangled. They were not dropped through
a
trap.
No, it was a big difference. You know, the whole Nuremberg thing is, people don't know what it was. It was all run by the Zionists.
Yeah,
all
yep.
of them. The
well,
whole
it was,
thing.
Yeah, it was a tribunal. It was not called a trial.
No.
They were guilty. You know, it was just revenge is all it was. But that's another ball game.
Mm-hmm.
Again, your listeners can join us. We go there every September. And you meet all sorts of veterans there, lots of veterans. And we go places, like I say, nobody else can go. Photo 3, for instance, anybody can go there. That's the Luftwaffe Memorial, and the only reason it is still there is because it started out as a Luftwaffe Memorial to the World War I guys. If it was World War II only, they would have torn it down. Photo SG4, was the their version of the Unknown Soldier or the Memorial Flame, whatever. This is the place, if you mm-hmm. remember, in Triumph of the Will, where mm-hmm. Hitler and Himmler and one other guy would walk solemnly through the hundreds of thousands of troops all standing at attention
mm-hmm.
to go here, and they would light the sacred flame here. It's still there. It hasn't been torn down, but it's kind of falling apart. SG5, that's the Congress Hall. It's built like the Colosseum in Rome.
Yes.
But you could put the Colosseum inside of this thing with room to spare.
Huh.
This was used as a field hospital during the war because it uh-huh. never was finished. It was used as a field hospital, and once Germany surrendered, the Allies took over. It was the American forces that took over this area, and they found there were 17 Waffen-SS soldiers in there, wounded, and they just hauled them out in this courtyard and shot them all dead right there. Being in the SS, I guess, had its drawback.
That's, I assume that's red brick construction.
It is. It is. And it was originally planned mm-hmm. to have this massive, gigundo, clear glass dome over the whole thing here,
mm-hmm.
but like mm-hmm. I say, it never got around to being finished. Photo 6, that was Hitler's personal door to get into the Congress Hall. He had his own door,
mm-hmm.
and with the nice dome on it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful place. We go there, and that's right nearby the stadium, the Zeppelinfeld, where he goes up and stands in front of all those zillions of people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we go there. Anybody can go there. Anybody can stand on that very same place. Just don't put your right arm in the air because the police are there, and it'll cost you 2,500 euros, which is about $3,500.
Yeah, that's all. They've got cameras there now, too, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Nothing's in the dark. But you see the picture number 8, with the truck and that big red sign and everything and that yellow sign on the gate.
Yeah.
That yellow sign says, Shark Hunters, welcome here.
Uh-huh.
It says, I'm Dang Verboten.
Mm-hmm.
This is inside that big stadium. And you see in photo number 9 and 10, that's inside the stadium, a huge big reception hall, and the gold swastikas are still in the ceiling, inlaid.
Hmm.
And Hitler used to have receptions in there. And a big dome, upside-down dome-looking thing. That was one of the fire braziers from outside. They brought it in. There were only two of them. They found the other one that was being used in a city park as a kiddie swimming pool.
Were they cooked meat in that?
No. It's a huge thing. It's about 15 feet across.
Oh, is that big?
Yeah, and they were on either end of the podiums outside.
Oh, and they, okay, I got it.
Fill them with the fuel oil and light them up.
Yeah, light them up, yeah. Wow, what a scene.
Oh, man. Well, you've seen them in the picture.
Well, they had a sense for drama that has never been equaled. Never.
You're not kidding. Boy, we participated in one of the, what they call a Stern March down in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
The Stern March means a star march, where thousands of people come from the four points of the compass, march into town, and from the sky it looked like a gigantic cross being formed.
Mm.
We were there in 1990 as guests of Jörg Haider, who was assassinated in 2008, but that's another old story.
He certainly was. We need to do that story one time. I really respected that man. He had a chance to rekindle things that the enemy would not allow.
Yeah, the problem with him was he was so incredibly wealthy he couldn't be bought.
Yeah.
So they bumped him off. But that's another story. I just met with another one of my people over there who, I can't get into any more of it, but we're about to come out with an expose.
Okay.
We've got about half of the book here. The other half is ready to come in.
Very good.
But that's another story. So.
Got it.
Then when we're there at the Zeppelinfeld, we have lunch at what they refer to as Hitler's train station, because he always got off the train at this train station right behind the big stadium.
Hmm.
And as you see in photos 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, they've got it made up to look just like a 1938 train station.
Yeah.
And in photo 14, the guy with the suit sitting down with no hair.
Yeah.
He's also a member of Shark Hunters for, 10, 15 years. And he is why Eingang Verboten means Shark Hunters are welcome. He's the assistant mayor. He's a lieutenant colonel in their army. He's a battalion commander.
Hmm.
And like I say, he's the assistant to the mayor, so he's got all the keys. And
what city is this for
Nuremberg.
Our listeners? It's Hamburg, all right.
Nuremberg.
No, I mean, we're still in Nuremberg. Okay.
Nuremberg, yeah. We don't get to Hamburg on our southern Germany tour because it's in the north of Germany.
Okay. I see. That's very clever the way they've done that. Luggage up there and everything. That's neat.
Oh, yeah. The old luggage from that kind of time, yeah. You know, with the leather straps around it and everything.
Yep.
Now, this fellow that I'm talking about there, I'm going out of my way not to use his name. He has a huge museum we go to, and that's that picture of the flag.
Is this the guy that befriended Manfred?
No.
This all right.
Is, no, the guy that befriended Manfred, we'd be happy to see him back in prison.
Yeah, all right.
No, this is a good friend of ours, and he's got this museum,
mm-hmm.
and it's got stuff for the German military from back in the Franco-Prussian War all the way up to modern day.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy with the swastika flag there, it is legal. You can show the flag legally as long as you fold it to where that whole swastika doesn't show. Because if
people see
an entire swastika, their brain will melt.
Oh, yes, I've seen pictures of people on the streets with stuff coming out of their ears.
Yeah, what mm-hmm. can I say?
By the way, there's... years ago, there was a factory in Germany that made flags during the war, And apparently they never stopped making them because the demand for them worldwide is kept them in business. They still make these flags.
It's only illegal over there.
Yeah. What is it about Germany? I know this is a rhetorical statement, but there's something about Germany that absolutely fascinates and intrigues people. And there are many reasons for it, but there is no other military, no other political system in history that has inspired and continues to mesmerize and incite anger and rage and all the rest of it in people. That's why German memorabilia is such a big deal.
Yeah, we go to a military show in the last weekend in February and first of March, called the Show of Shows up in Louisville.
Yeah.
And
my art probably ended up there. Who knows?
It could be, because there's 2,200 tables, and I'd say a good 80% of it is Third Reich.
What we need to do is try. I need to have one piece someday.
Of what?
Art.
Oh, okay.
One piece of art. That's will fill
it. Art?
Yeah.
Save your pennies, because it's going to cost you a ton of money.
I know.
Yeah, of course you know better than I do.
Yeah.
We've got copies, but the originals, roll out the big wallet.
Yeah.
If I had that kind of money, I'd be driving a Lamborghini instead.
Nah, you wouldn't. You'd be in trouble. Too fast.
Yeah, well, some of the artwork that you can find in Germany, or no, they had an auction some years ago in Italy of Hitler's work.
Well, they were 50,000 and up.
Well, yeah, but the problem there was, by law, you could not take it out of Italy. So what's the sense of buying it if you can't take it home?
That's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, and the reason I want, if for some of you, if you're curious, it's not because I am overwhelmed with absolute admiration and lust for World War II Germany. It's because of the history of it. This is all about history. History. Okay. It's a piece of history.
True enough, yep.
And Harry knows exactly what I'm saying. All right.
I do this 14 hours a day.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah. And no salary. Fortunately, I'm an old fart. I don't have any bills. And I do okay on my Social Security, and that's what we live on.
Yeah. All right, number 18.
18. These are some of the veterans. Like I say, we get together with veterans.
You're not going to go bald, that's for damn sure.
No, I'm not going to go bald. The guy on the left, Bill, the big stocky guy, he's a U.S. Marine veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Two combat tours in Vietnam. He was a machine gunner. The guy in the middle, the old guy with the white hair, that's Manfred Thorn.
Mm-hmm.
He was first SS, which was the Leibstandarte to Adolf Hitler.
See, now this is amazing. These people are still alive, a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. And he's in good shape, too.
Yeah.
And the other one, the one in the yellow shirt, that's me, U.S. Air Force veteran.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only one of the three that never saw combat. I wanted to, we were told how horrible the Russians were, and I wanted to kill Russians when I got in. They told me I couldn't because there was no war going on. And then, later on I met. Well, I was invited to Russia in 1991 when it was the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited by Vladimir Chernyavin, who was the last five-star commanding supreme commander of all the Soviet forces, and he was ordered to invite me by Mikhail Gorbachev.
That's fascinating.
By the time I was done, they made me a commissar of the Soviet Union. I was commissar in the Peace to the Oceans Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's all gone since there's no more Soviet Union. But I'm still an honorary Russian submarine officer. And they're no different than us. Just our government and our government didn't get along so well, that's all. But they were normal people like us. And I found out that one of my ancestors lived in Russia for a while, and everybody loved him. When we got off the plane, we were on Admiral Chernyavin's plane in 1992 when I went over there, and our pilot come running up, and he had a book in Russian, Leather Stocking Tales, the Last of the Mohicans and the Deerslayer.
Yeah.
James Fenimore Cooper. He was an ancestor. I'm sitting here looking right now at a whole bunch of first issues that have been passed down in our family since James Fenimore Cooper. He come running up. He wanted me to sign the book for his daughter, Natasha. And then I didn't even know it, but I found out Fenimore Cooper lived over there for some years. So they're no different than us.
No, but you get them one-on-one.
And that's right. Governments are the ones that cause the problem. People can get along.
Well, it's the whole Soviet era through World War II was a Bolshevik enterprise. And the Bolsheviks slaughtered the Russian people like no one before since.
Oh, 20, 25 million people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, the real bad guys were told that Hitler was the most horrible of the bunch. Not true.
No.
Nope. Stalin was just incredibly horrible.
He made Hitler look like a Cub Scout. Bomber Harris, guy, one of the biggest war criminals in history, without question.
Yeah, bombing cities where there were no war things. Eisenhower with his starvation camps. And the two worst, in my opinion, are Churchill and Roosevelt.
I'm with you. I know a lot of people listening may think FDR was the cat's meow and a great leader, and many people believe that, and so it was. But in point of fact, the administration was riddled with Bolsheviks, communists, and all of our secrets were being sent to the Soviet Union throughout the war and afterwards.
Just like Bill Clinton giving away so much to the Chinese.
He gave our best supercomputers to them because they promised us that they would never be used for military purposes.
Well, of course, you got to believe that. I had a group in China in the early 90s, and they were showing us some of their cities gearing up to be massive industrial, and I'm thinking, who the hell's going to buy Chinese-made stuff? Well, we're funding their entire military complex, not only the United States, all of Europe, and as you know, I go down to Argentina quite a bit.
Yeah.
You can't buy anything down there but what it ain't made in China, anywhere.
Same down there, huh?
Right. It's made in China, everywhere.
Their economy has surpassed ours. It is the number one in the world now.
And their military is rapidly catching up to ours.
Well, they're very good at back engineering.
Reverse engineering, sure.
And spying and bribing people. And they can walk away with 20, 25 years of our research and development in 10 minutes with the right amount of money. And everybody's got a price.
And they've got the money. I mean, we're buying everything made in China.
Of course, yeah.
My wife won't buy any food if it's made in China because...
She shouldn't.
No.
You should eat nothing from China. That's one thing you don't do.
Right, and we don't,
That includes pet food.
Right. When we're buying stuff in the store, we look, and if it's made in China, I'm not a real easy guy to get along with. I make a hell of a fuss right there in the aisle until I get some clerk to come running over and show me the same thing made in America. If it costs a couple bucks more, okay, so what? Pay for it.
Good for you.
So,
good job.
But anyhow, then we go... Now, remember, your listeners can come with us on some of these tours. All they got to do is send us an email, say they want information. We'll send it to them. The highlight of our southern tour, which we do every year, you see in photo number 19 and 20. This is the memorial on the Holy Mountain there, which is Ulrich Mountain, Ulrichsberg. There's a ruined church. At the very top with a gigantic cross.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people there, veterans. I made my first speech there in 1990 as a guest of Jörg Haider. And back in those days, Austria was a sovereign nation. And I remember standing up there at the podium, and there were thousands of people in front of me, and the sun was bouncing off all the knight's crosses they were wearing.
Oh, they wore their honors. Oh,
they
nice.
Did. And Haider invited my group to a private reception with a bunch of the veterans, and anybody who could fit into their uniform wore it, even with that red armband with the swastika.
Amazing.
But now, oh, God forbid,
yeah,
your brain will melt.
Or
so,
worse. Or worse. All right, we have another set of photos to go through. We'll get through these.
Let's go as fast as you want.
Well, let's just keep going here.
Okay.
Todd, we're going to just, let's just go. I want to make sure we get all these pictures in. We'll go right through the break here. Go ahead.
All right. We'll slip up to number 22. That's our friend Bill Napier again, the U.S. Marine combat veteran. And he's with Siegfried. Now, Siegfried was 5th SS, the Viking Division. We meet so many of these guys over there. And you see in 24 and 25, more of the ceremony on the mountain. We'll skip back to 23 in a minute. I don't even know why 23 is there. Forget 23. 24 and 25, 26, 27, and 28, and all the way down to the rest of the, through the end of it, that's all the ceremony up on Rolex Mountain. If you look on 29, are you looking at 29 there?
I am at 26 looking at some of the old folks sitting on the bench who obviously have a book or two in each one of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. 29. I see it.
Okay. The fella there, the older fella.
Uh-huh.
Powell Roche.
Uh-huh.
5th SS. He was an Oberleutnant. He was a tank commander in the Viking Division, 5th SS.
Wow.
And this was last year. That old fart was 94 last year. Look at that picture. He don't look 94.
No, that's amazing.
I was there a couple years before that, around the winter time, and he was showing me the city center there in Klagenfurt, Austria, southern Austria. And I'm in good shape. I had to run to keep up with this guy. He was walking. He was 93, 92 at the time, and I had to run to keep up with this guy. And he meets with us all the time. His wife passed away about 5 years ago. He's got a new lady. He's got an Italian lady. She can't speak German. He can't speak Italian.
That's why they get along.
They find a way to talk somehow.
No, that's why they get along.
I mean, yeah, could be. Neither one drives the other one nuts. But you see all the veterans there, and we are welcomed as family. I mean, you can't just show up and be part of this ceremony. You have to have an invitation. And we are invited, warmly invited. I've been made ambassador to Ulrichsburg. So the shark hunters always get a place of honor. And the Friday and the Saturday before the big event, they have a huge, big shindig at a restaurant. And they have music. And, I mean, you buy whatever you want to eat. But all the old veterans are there. And I remember, 2 years ago, I was talking to a friend in a side room, and suddenly, my God, the walls were shaking. They were singing the Panzerlied of Sturm oder's Night, and all the old guys were singing. There was a bunch of guys come from England who are right-wing. They're in there with them all, and the walls were shaking. They were singing, and just everybody getting along great with everybody. Germans and Americans mingling and being friends. And you wonder how could we have ever shot at each other back in those days.
Well, we fought the wrong enemy in World War II. Anybody with a brain knows that.
Right.
The banksters set it up.
It was necessary to destroy Germany. That's what they were saying.
Well, Hitler, I mean, was the object of Churchill's statement in the book, his autobiography. Churchill, as vile a human being as he was, spoke one line of truth, at least in his autobiography. He said, the war had nothing to do with the Nazi Party, National Socialism, nothing. The war was fought to destroy Germany and its people, once and for all. That's what it was.
Right, yeah, no question about it. And they pretty well achieved that because the average German is afraid of their own government. With good cause, because if you get caught, if you show a swastika out in public, you go to jail. If you march around with your right arm in the air, you're either going to get a fine or go to jail.
If your dog holds up his right arm, you can go to jail. Remember that?
Yeah. This year when we were there, this nice guy had that dog, and he would give the command in German, Mach dem Führer. Dog would sit down and raise his right paw up in the air, and then he'd wait for a cookie. Pretty clever dog.
Mm-hmm.
That was Nils's dog, Mach dem Führer. But the younger people now, the people in their 20s and 30s, they're starting to open their eyes and say, wait a minute, you know, this is our history, and it's not the horrible, evil history that we're taught.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. So some of them still are butt-kissing, but, you know
the liquidation of Germany didn't end in 1945 in April. Between 1945 and 1953, an estimated 5 to 8 million more Germans were killed.
Yeah.
Quietly, didn't make the papers, but those were the last hardcore of the German population that survived the war, and most of them were liquidated by world Zionism. They wanted them all dead.
Well, yeah, they didn't want patriots hanging around.
No,
but those who went to South America, they at least got out with their skin.
Yep.
Whereas those who stayed, the Tito partisans killed God knows how many of them. And, those that got sent back to Ukraine, they were so-called repatriated. They never got more than 10 feet from the boxcars, and they were machine guns.
Yep.
What a fun outfit there, World War II.
Okay, let's go on to wrap this up and head to the next batch. We'll get through those.
Okay, yeah, people can join us. Just send me an email at the address on the on all the postcard or on all the photos there, and tell us you want information on whatever you want, and we'll send it to you.
Okay, photos, summer solstice number 3. We got a map.
Summer solstice number 3?
Group of, we're in the third group of photos.
The third group, that's, they're just lettered A, B, and C, and D.
That's right.
Okay.
It's
a
map.
Nobody ever called me dumb and didn't mean it.
No, that's a map.
These were photocopied off the chart that Pizarro gave me, and that chart is beat to shreds from all the marching around that Pizarro has done down there in South America. Literally had to put it together like a jigsaw puzzle. And some of the important things on there, we look at number A, or letter A, whatever you want to call it. And, hold on, I got to get my glasses. I don't know how big it is on your screen, but here I just got to print it out thing. Anyhow, you see where it says, what does it say there?
Paraguay.
Paraguay Chico.
Uh-huh.
That's a little town in Chile, just across the border from Argentina, and that's where Borman died. And according to Pizarro, he was buried there in the local cemetery.
Huh.
But then he was dug up and brought back to Germany and deposited where they were digging at the train station, and somebody said, oh, look, it's Marty. And that's how they came to find him at their train station. Alleged.
What'd they do with him?
That's a good question. I don't know what they did with the body. Well, nobody has Hitler's body either. They have a piece of a skull that they said was his. But
it's DNA showed it was a woman.
That's right, a younger woman. So they don't have anybody's body.
And the infamous photograph of Hitler allegedly with a bullet in the head was one of his doubles. It wasn't a very good double.
And we know who that double was. And that information is going to be in the next issue of the magazine, KTV number 267, which is going together. Pizarro has dug that up, and in our meeting, Pizarro gave me the name. We don't have a photograph, not much more than the name and his relationship to Hitler.
How interesting.
That'll be in the next issue of the magazine.
Wow, great.
And, I can tell you now how they got away. And it all boils down to that last JU-390. Remember that gigantic airplane we were talking about? They built 3 of them.
It's on the cover of the book.
That's it. JU-390-V3, never got finished. V1 made a circuitous flight down over Johannesburg and back without stopping, no refueling. And then it had broken down or something, and they took the propellers off of that for JU-390-V2, which was 3 meters longer, which is about 10 feet, which meant it had a lot more fuel capacity, and that's the one that flew down to Uruguay. And you've seen the charts. They were on your show a couple of months ago. They've also been in our magazine. They're also in one of the books, the newer book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance.
Yeah.
Because that that airfield at, what the heck was the airfield, Steinmetz or something like that. It was surrounded by the Red Army, but there was also huge number of cracked SS troops holding the line because they had that one 390 there, and they had a bunch of 290s, and this 390 flew out, and according to Pizarro's research, it had the so-called Nazi bell on board, the Glock, and it had 9 passengers, one of which was Uncle Adi, and the other was Eva Braun, and it was painted powder blue, and it had Swedish Air Force markings on it, and we know where it landed, and we know what happened to it. When I go down there in March, we're going to try to find pieces of it.
So we're pretty sure that they were flown down there.
Yes. Yes.
He didn't. He didn't like submarines.
He didn't like anything to do with the water. He got seasick, and there was a excuse me. There was a big yacht. I think it belonged to the King of Sweden or something. It was called the Aviso Gorilla. And that was grabbed by the Kriegsmarine after they overran whatever country that was. And that was, so-called pseudo-historians refer to that as Hitler's yacht. He never had a yacht. And one story I read was where he and Eva Braun used to come and have wild romantic trysts. That's baloney. She was never on the boat at all, the ship. And he was only on it to receive foreign guests, and he got seasick. So the idea of him spending 3 months in a submarine, whereas he could only, could have gotten away for 18 hours in an airplane.
So we think that the bell was on the plane with him?
Yes. That's what Pizarro's research has shown.
Pizarro is not wrong about many things.
He's never been wrong on anything.
Did you see your computer? I sent you a picture of the bell.
How long ago?
An hour and a half.
No, that's back at the office and I'm here.
Oh, okay.
At the house.
Yeah, it came from the Discovery Channel, but it's a pretty good mock-up.
Okay.
The Glock, it's the German, you can call it anti-gravity, the German UFO, the German flying saucer, but it looked like a bell.
Yeah. And it's hard to pin down what it actually did.
We don't know, except they say that the workers who worked on it were, I guess, Czechs or something, and they were told, if you look out your window, you will be shot through the window. Do not look, no matter what you hear. Apparently the thing was noisy as hell.
Yeah.
And
is that what they call a canceled Czech?
Could be.
The one guy in this world who is the expert, Igor Witkowski, he's a very nice guy, and he's happy to talk to you like mad, but when it gets down to the final details, he just dances around the question.
Can we get him on the program sometime?
I don't know. I can ask him if you want. Remind me in the email you're going to send me, because we're in contact quite a bit. He was a member of Shark Hunters. And he is the world expert on the Glock. I've got his book here, Secrets of the Wonder Weapons, but it reads a lot like a technical manual. It's kind of hard going.
Okay. All right, so the map that we're looking at is, we got to do a break. I missed that.
Sell some stuff.
Yeah, well, we appreciate our sponsors, and we will do this and come right back. Okay, back with Harry. and looking at this. Anything else on the map that we want to look at? This map is a newer map. Obviously, it's not vintage 1945.
Right.
And
it's primarily how everything links in together. You got Paraguay Chico there on map A.
Uh-huh.
And right there, the big circle, that's San Carlos de Bariloche, which is where Hitler lived from 1945 until 55. That's also where the German scientist built an atomic research laboratory.
Yeah.
Built it in 1947, 2 years after the war was over. And then the items along BC, those are important points along the coast. But item D, you've seen what we're doing with that in the magazine. The last outpost of the German Reich was down there.
Mm-hmm.
On, oh boy, it escapes me now. Where the heck was it? Right by Island Santa Maria, in a little channel. Well, you saw it in the last issue of the magazine, and this issue is going to have even more about it down there with photos, and it was still going in 1947, we know about.
Huh.
And a couple of the German sailing vessels were there, the Pastim, and another one, the name escapes me right now, but, and I'm just, well, I'm, while you were on break, I'm sitting there going over all the stuff that I've got from Pizarro that's going to go into the next issue about the JU-390 and where it went. And it says right here that Hans Kammler's deputy in charge, who was Dr. Wilhelm Voss, was interviewed by the British in 1951 in the town of Rottach. Agern, and Voss claimed that the 390 was, I'm reading right what Pizarro sent me. Voss claimed that the JU-390 was used to evacuate a centrifuge which ionized mercury called the Nazi Bell from Silesia, which would have been that, that airfield, but I can't remember the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on, an SS report held at the Berlin Document Center states that this second JU-390, oh, here's the name of the airport, okay, that 390, which was the V-2, the prototype was at Schweidnitz near Breslau in April 1945 for the evacuation of Kammler's Bell project. So.
Wow. What are you quoting? What are you quoting from again? There.
This is something that Pizarro sent me.
Mm-hmm.
Pizarro also mentioned that it was accompanied for a certain length of time by Dr. Elizabeth Adler, who was supposedly the leading mathematician in all of Europe at the time, and she had two Abwehr bodyguards. And we, in this next issue of the magazine, you'll see we plot their progress across Europe up to a point, and then nobody knows where they are. They were either shot dead by the Red Army, or they were grabbed by the Red Army. We don't know. Oh, another thing that Pizarro told me, which just really puts a huge piece into the puzzle. From 23rd of April onward, no orders were signed by Hitler. All orders after 23rd April were signed by Martin Bormann. Hitler didn't commit suicide, if you believe the story.
Mm-hmm.
The suicide was supposed to be on the 30th of April.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he do on those 7 days? Was he on vacation or what? No, horse feathers. He was gone. And Bormann signed all the orders from 23rd April onward.
So Bormann got him out of there. Now, what's interesting about this is that the trade-off, and some of you remember us talking about this, was that the Germans and others who were affiliated with the Third Reich could go to Argentina and live unmolested in exchange for technology. Wernher von Braun, all these scientists. Yeah, of course. But they didn't get the bell.
Right. And we're still trying to figure out what happened to the bell, where it is, because it ain't on that island. And I was talking to another person who's pretty knowledgeable about the bell, excuse me, and whatever it generated, and said it would have required a very, very large building, empty building with no walls or anything, but a very large building. And I pointed his attention to that one building we found on that island Hoimel, down in Patagonia, which is where the Atomic Research Laboratory was. And here's this huge, big building with nothing in it but square holes in the wall about every 6 feet up and down and every 6 feet left and right.
Hmm.
And it wasn't for stabilizing wood.
Right.
We don't know what the heck it was for.
Yeah, that's very strange.
Right, and these square holes.
Were they glassed or just holes?
Just holes.
Mm-hmm.
Just holes.
Mm-hmm.
And you, what the hell? Why would somebody build all these square holes that look like a waffle iron?
Mm-hmm. No.
And no roof, of course, anymore, because the wood had either rotted away or people had taken the wood after the island was abandoned in the early 1950s. There was another building that had diesel engines in it running the generators to provide the power for the island. And then after the scientists all left and the place was deserted, they took the generators and the diesels and brought them into town. That's what made their electricity in town. And you mentioned where Werner von Braun came to the United States, which he did. He had 40 tons of documents that he had hidden out in a cave, and he was using that as his bargaining chip between Uncle Sam and Uncle Joe. Who wants me and who's got the best deal? And he brought a bunch of scientists with him, but other guys like Kurt Tank, Professor Kurt Tank, the guy that designed the Focke Wulf FW-190 fighter, he went to Argentina. The Americans want him, the Soviets wanted him, but he went to Argentina with about 50 aeronautical engineers, and he was building fighters for South American air forces. And I think I told you once before, when I got back this January, this very nice old man down there at the main base, old man, he's probably 20 years younger than me, he gave me a DVD on the history of the Argentine Air Force, Badia, Force Argentina, Aeronautica, whatever. And I was watching it, and they had a camera set up in front of one of the, or kind of on top of one of the hangars, and they were taxiing the planes past. This was somewhere in the late 1950s, I think.
Oh, we've seen a picture of this.
Right, they're taxiing it, and here's a Horton, for God's sake.
Unbelievable.
I fell out of my chair.
Well,
I had to call the guy up. I said, what the hell? There was a Horton in there. Oh, yeah, the Horton brothers came here. Didn't you know that? No, I didn't know that. They were building flying wings down there. We've got a photo of a Horton bomber flying over the Brazilian rainforest.
Well,
then they were building flying wings for the Argentine Air Force for cargo and transport. That was the ugliest damn thing. It looked like a Winnebago motorhome hung underneath a big wing. Just looked ridiculous. But they worked. None are left, unfortunately, because they were all broken up after their usefulness.
Well, if you do any research on the Northrop flying wing that we built.
Oh, yeah. XB-49.
Exactly. Directly derivative of the Horton brothers and their work.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's the story about that is fascinating, because the Northrop employees loved that plane. They just thought it was the greatest, and they wanted to convert it from, it had push propellers in the back.
Right. That was when it was the XB 39, I think it was, before they went to the jet. I saw one when I was just a little kid. The war was just over. We were living at my grandparents' house at 1539 North Mayfield in Chicago, right there north in Austin. And I was about 5 years old, and I hear all this noise. I look up, and here's this gigantic wing flying overhead, slow. It was not
you
a fast
saw
aircraft.
It.
Wow. And I thought, what in the hell is this thing? Where's the body? But then they switched over to making it a jet. And one of our members, who's now dead, unfortunately, Bob Cardenas, he was the test pilot that flew it.
Unbelievable. Now
he
this
also got to fly the Arado AR-234s that we brought back over here. He was the test pilot on those things.
Six more months. That's all it would have taken. Things would have been much different, at least in terms of the air war.
The history is coming out now that Germany was within 6 months of being able to make a mess out of New York City.
Yeah, and largely cleanse the skies of the hordes of bombers, too. They had guided missiles on the just about to deploy. They had all kinds of things.
Yeah, and they had their intercontinental ballistic missile almost within 6 months of being able to reach New York City. That was the A-9-810 or whatever the heck.
The thing about Northrop I wanted to tell you is that they wanted to put the jet engines in it, and Congress, for some reason, wouldn't give the money. The Pentagon wouldn't give the money. The employees were so hot and dedicated to that plane, they offered to do it for free, for no pay. This is true. They offered to build all these planes from propeller to jet power on their own time. That's how much they believed in it. But the program went black. It was too good. It went to black ops, and that's where, of course, we get the B-2 and so forth.
Right.
It's all German technology, ultimately.
There's no question about that. And some of my German friends over there, they start bending my ear. They're mad because, the Allies stole, they said, like 350,000 German patents. Well, okay, but, they say to the spoil, to the victor go the spoils,
the spoils
of war. That's
every
just
time.
A polite way of saying we're going to steal from somebody that can't fight back.
Correct. Yeah.
The ballpoint pen came from Germany. I remember that when I was a kid in first grade.
You saw a flying wing. Wow.
I saw a flying wing.
Amazing. There are United States Air Force Northrop N9M flying wing is an exact copy of the Horton brothers. HO9 or whatever it was.
I don't remember what the nomenclature was, because they never built many of them. But
no, but that would have been it.
They didn't have the manufacturing capability. I mean, look at
they were making things out of wood, for goodness sake.
Right. Well, that helped with its stealth capacity, though, capabilities. But look at the JU-390. They worked their ass off, and they made three of them. How many B-29s did we make? About one an hour.
Was 10,000 or something? I don't know.
Oh, more than that, I think it was. And machine guns, we built more each month average than Japan built in the whole war.
Yeah, well,
so we overwhelmed, with the American manufacturing capabilities and the massive numbers of Russians. How do you stand up against that?
Yeah, you don't. Harry, go get some sleep. Thank you. That was a lot of fun. And we will do it again next month. And get some rest. Have a great day tomorrow.
All right. Don't forget, your listeners, check out the photographs and go to the website.
We will.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Good night. All right, we'll be right back with Hour 3.